the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you very much. That, of course, was my beautiful brunette wife, Sarita, singing Sunny with the incomparable Joe Pass trio, Ella Fitzgerald's very favorite guitarist, and of course, my very, very favorite singer from the time I was a kid in Toronto in the 40s, Francis Sinatra, the night he took over the Tonight Show and had me come on to do a stand-up, somebody with whom I'll forever be indebted. He's one of only two people I ever met in this business who kept his word to me. This is John Barber. We're here in John Barber's world in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I must tell you, it is absolutely freezing here. A cold wind is blowing. The town, as you probably know, is preparing for tomorrow night another Republican debate, this time at the Venetian. And this weather might be the omen that all those political prognosticators predicted, that it would be a cold day in hell when a Republican gets elected. And around town, liberals are calling this congregation, this debate, the Grinches who stole democracy. In our Western neighbor in California, Governor Brown and their legislature have just signed a law that allows immigrants to vote. Well, I think in that case, if they're going to allow immigrants to vote, they should allow them to run for office. And it might improve our choices, because I know a number of folks, and I might be amongst them, who would write in Vladimir Putin. Do you know, in Russia, when you pick up the phone to make a call, a voice never says, dial one for Russian and dial two for Arabic. And this right now is probably the biggest thing and maybe the only thing that Trump has going for him, that one day, should he win, when you pick up the phone, it will only say, dial one for English. Sorry, there is no dial two for Spanish any longer. Anyway, we are less than 2 weeks from Christmas. A day that lasts 24 hours, but a season, according to retailers, it seems to last 24 weeks. For me, now listen, that's just for me. December 25th, this questionable birthday 2015 years ago of a man named Joshua ben Joseph, better known to some of you as Jesus Christ, is not nearly as important as the birth date of a man, a writer, a television writer who brought me not only much more pleasure, but also much more intellectual stimulation. In actuality, television is a medium. And an old radio comic, Fred Allen, once said they call it a medium because it's seldom well done. A medium that has had a very short life. If you compared television to a human, as a growing adolescent, you might have described him as a precocious prodigy, maybe a genius, who sadly as an adult maybe didn't quite turn into a serial killer, but a killer of truth, a killer of talent, and a killer of the necessary information to nourish this dying democracy. But in the few years that television mattered, there were three genius writers who made it matter. Reginald Rose, who wrote, amongst other great live television plays, 12 Angry Men, and the incomparable Paddy Chayefsky, a prodigious talent who also went on to upgrade movies such as Marty, the Americanization of Emily, Jimmy Garner's very best film, and of course, one of the world's most literate and still informing films, the classic standalone Network. The third, and of course the most recognizable, was Born on Christmas Day. Sadly, excuse me. Oh, I just finished reading the book. Sadly, he died much too young, 40 years ago, at 50. But to this day, for us and future generations, his gift is a gift that keeps on giving. We see it thankfully and often in the reruns of one of the greatest series, if not greatest series ever written for American television, The Twilight Zone. Aside from his brilliant work, he left a brilliant daughter who also inherited the father's way with words. She spent 7 years working out the grief of her loss and ours. Writing, as you can tell, a very, very moving and informative book about the man who was her father. I finished reading it last night and just loved it. It's called As I Knew Him. I'm honored to have her here with me tonight, Ann Sertling. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, John.
Please forgive me. I mean, I don't know where that came from, but I was so moved by your book. And I guess I would begin this way. Even if someone had no interest in your father, Rod Serling, or the magnificent work that he did, if a child has lost a beloved parent, this would be such a cathartic read for them. So let's begin this way. Instead of talking about your father, first of all, let's talk about your grief, how it struck you, how old you were when your father died, and why was it that this grief seemed to impact you more than it seemed to impact your sister or your mother? Go ahead.
Well, to your first question, I had just turned 20 when my dad died. He died about 3 weeks after I turned 20. I would say that we all, my mother, my sister, and I, we all grieved, and I wrote this in the book, we all grieved separately. I can't really speak to their grief. I can only speak to my own. But I can say this, that we all thought that this open heart surgery was the answer. My father felt that too. He was feeling very positive. Although this was, 1975, and open heart surgery was a brand new procedure back then. But we were all stunned when he died. And it was a huge loss all those many, many years ago, and it's still a huge loss. I miss my father every day.
Why did it take you 7 years to write the book?
Well, a few years after he died, I actually started another book, because like my dad, I find writing cathartic, and I started another book called In His Absence, and I couldn't finish that book because I was still so in the throes of grief, and I didn't realize it, but I hadn't even begun to navigate that whole minefield. So I had to set that aside, and then when I started this one, it took a long time. I think it takes a long time to write a book. I'm not unique in that, but I think a huge piece of this was still working through my grief. And then I wanted to find out more about my dad professionally, and I sort of wanted to set the record straight about who he was.
When you were suffering this grief, Anne, did you have to seek psychiatric help?
After about a year after my dad died, I did. I did see a psychiatrist because I was becoming agoraphobic, and I didn't even know what that was. I don't even know if that was a word back then. Certainly not a common word. But I felt that I was falling apart.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Was it his idea for you to write the book? Was it your husband's idea to write the book, your family's idea, or was it your idea?
It was certainly my idea, and I think my husband definitely was a huge support and a huge encouragement in that.
Okay, now you get into the research of going rummaging through the life of your father and this treasure trove of material, the letters and the scripts and all the rest of it. And when you got into it, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about your father?
Well, I think, you know, to that, most surprising thing. Well, let me first say, I think one of the most difficult things about writing the book beyond having to face my grief head on was writing the chapters about when my dad was in training camp before he was sent to the Philippines. And I found the letters that his parents had written to him and he had written to them just so devastating. My own son was 19 at the time, the same age my dad was when he went to the Philippines. And it just really drove home how young these kids are that we send off to these wars. And because I knew that my dad's dad would die while my father was overseas and he would never see him again, it was just particularly poignant and tremendously sad to read all of those letters.
One of the wonderful things about the book is a lot of the correspondence that you have amongst between you and your father and between your father and friends of his. And chapter 7, which is really moving, gets to the point of when he was a paratrooper, and he was only 5 feet 4 inches tall. That's a very funny comment he had made. You might tell me what he had wanted to be a quarterback on a football team when he went to school. What was it the coach said to him? Do you remember?
Something about he didn't weigh any more than the team mascot, the bulldog. So something.
That's right. But he ended up being an excellent paratrooper, and this was and he used to write home. He used to send verses, and I ran across, in looking at this, I'm just going to read the last two stanzas because you don't have it probably in front of you. But it's as relevant today as it was back in the 40s when he was over there in the foxholes in the Philippines. And the last two stanzas of this poem are, "At night, we lie in our pillows with ills no doctor can cure. Hell no, we're not convicts, just soldiers on a tour. We have but one consolation, and that to you I shall tell. When we die, we'll all go to heaven, because we've done our hitch in hell." I mean, that is so brilliant. He's only 19 years of age, and at the time, he did not want to be a writer. I mean, he did not aspire to be a writer, according to what the book says.
True. In fact, he was going to go into teaching phys ed to kids because he liked working with kids. But writing, I don't think, was really ever a consideration. And he only switched to writing after he went to Antioch because he was still so devastated by all the experiences from the war and his dad dying. And his quote was something about he needed to write, he needed to get it off his gut, or out of his gut, he needed to get it off his chest. And he then switched to language and literature.
When I was doing stand-up, when I knew Sinatra, I used to do a piece in my act about all of the really great things that happened to us in life happened by accident, while all the disasters are truly well planned. So I was really pleased when I came across that part that he accidentally became a writer because he accidentally you know, got a chance to express the genius. He also, even though he was 5 feet four, he was a very handsome young man, had a beautiful voice and a great sense of humor, and evidently seemed to have been quite a womanizer when he went to Antioch.
That's what I heard, that he had dated pretty much a lot of the girls and then met my mother.
How did he meet your mother, and why was he taken by your mother?
Well, I think the story that I heard from her was that when she first met him, he was pretending to be a gorilla, and she thought he was a bit of an idiot. But you know, clearly she saw that he was a bright, funny guy, and my mother's very bright, and I think that attracted him. So the rest is history.
And they got married. They didn't have much, I presume, when they got married, judging by that picture that you have in your book of them leaving the church to go on their honeymoon. So now he's writing. What was the first time he sold the story? To whom did he sell the story, and how much did he get for it?
It was a radio script that he sold, and it was called the Dr. Christian Award, and I think he got $100 for it. And Earl Hamner also, actually it was $500, I think. And that's where he first met the writer Earl Hamner, who had also been chosen.
Earl Hamner was the writer, folks, who went on to do the famous Waltons, a very nice show, but not nearly of the caliber of Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone. Okay, now he's buoyed up by the fact that he can make a little money writing. Then what does he do?
Well, then he was working at the radio station at Antioch, and then after he graduated, they moved to Cincinnati, and he was working on in a radio station there. And he would work in the radio station. He was writing, directing, and actually acting in all these scripts. And then he would go home and write. And that's where he acquired, I think, 40 rejections at that point. And then finally made it.
Oh, how old were you, Anne, when your father died?
I had just turned 20.
Did he ever have an opportunity to talk to you about those rejections, or did you ever have the opportunity to ask him? I mean, if somebody gets 40 rejections, don't you think they would give up what they were trying to do?
Actually, someone did tell him that, you know, you ought to give up writing because you're never going to make it. You're never going to be a writer. So,
well, we had Harlan Ellison on our last show. And as you know, Harlan is an eminently successful writer also, and did write a couple of Twilight Zones for your father. But he had a writing professor at school who told him he would never, ever make it as a writer. And for 10 years, every time Harlan got a job, he sent a copy of the check to the professor to let him know.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that.
Isn't that wonderful? Anyway, okay, so he's got 40 rejections. What was it, and how old was he when he suddenly got the break that began to make him?
His first big break was Pattern, and he was, I think probably in a, maybe 29, I think.
Okay, 29. Because I remember Patterns very well. I think Jack Gould at the New York Times said it was one of the greatest things to ever hit live American television.
Right. And then 2 years later, that was followed up by Requiem for a Heavyweight.
Jack Palance. Remember
right.
It? Yes, I remember it really well as a kid seeing that. I watched everything that your father wrote, absolutely everything. I was addicted to the way he thought and to the way he wrote. What always bothered me a little bit, though, was the fact that he just seemed to never be without a cigarette in his mouth.
Yeah, I think, you know, in part that was the time, but certainly, he was a heavy, heavy smoker. I often wonder if today he would still be smoking. I kind of think not, but I don't know.
I don't think that he, if he were around today, I have a feeling that he probably would not, because he as you can see, he was a prodigious reader and he loved to be informed. And I guess you would say politically he was extremely humanitarian and liberal. When did he move to Los Angeles and why did he move to Los Angeles?
Well, they moved to L.A. when live television died, so it must have been about 1958, I guess it was. And because all the writers, they said, were all moving west, so that's why.
And when he moved west, what was it he began to write then to support his family?
In trying to think when Requiem came out, that would have been around maybe just a little bit before that. And then Twilight Zone was 1959.
But Twilight Zone, I understand the first time around, they weren't too interested in Twilight Zone.
No, they bought the script and then they shelved it for a year. And the story is, and I'm not sure I know the story exactly, but a producer from Desilu Productions, they were looking for some good writing, and the producer dug it up and convinced they convinced CBS to air it. And then it got very high ratings.
Okay, then the next two questions, one being a very important question for anybody who is a writer in this business. Even though it was not something that CBS was thrilled with doing, and it was pushed on them by Desilu, was your father granted creative control over the show?
He was, and before I answer that, I just want to say, you know, he had written other things before The Twilight Zone. He very much wanted to write the story about Emmett Till. And
I remember that.
Right. And his script, they just blue-lined it and cut this and cut that, and he couldn't use the name of a certain college because it was a Southern college, and certain terms he couldn't use. And I think he tried to write that about three times. The last one was called A Town Has Turned to Dust, and he said by the end his script had turned to dust. And he was so frustrated because he just couldn't write about these things that he felt were so important.
And tell the audience what the Emmett Till story was.
Well, the Emmett Till story is about the African-American kid who had been accused of whistling at a white woman. And it was an all-white jury. Well, they murdered this child, and I can't remember how old he was, maybe 14, and the all-white jury acquitted the murderers in, it was just a very short trial, and my father, like so many people, was horrified by this case, and he felt that it needed to be spoken about and talked about, and he was so frustrated that he couldn't write about these important issues, and he realized in one script that he'd written that again the censors were just ripping it apart, and he finally, his quote was that an alien could say what a Democrat or a Republican couldn't, and so he thus launched The Twilight Zone, where all of these important messages were sort of slipping under the radar.
See, that was 55 years ago. It was the tail end of live television. It was the tail end of meaningful television. But your father still felt that he could tell a meaningful story.
Right, and to your other question, he had complete creative control with The Twilight Zone.
Well, fortunately for us, he did, because we'll get to some other things that he didn't, unfortunately, have creative control of. But imagine what he would think of television after 55 years in, where not even the most talented writers and producers in the industry would ever think of trying to tell a story as important as the Emmett Till story. I mean, they would self-censor before they even turned in one page to any one of the networks or any one of the cable stations. Okay, now they get to do the Twilight Zone. Okay, who was going to be the first host of the Twilight Zone?
Well, I can't remember the name of the first guy, but I know that they, I did mention it in my book, but his name is escaping me.
I think it was Westbrook Van Voorhis, the guy that used to do the March of Time.
Right, and then, and then they wanted Orson Welles, but Orson Welles proved to be too expensive, and I think they felt that his, or it may have been the guy you mentioned, they felt his voice was a little too pompous, and my dad volunteered, which wasn't met with huge excitement at first, but he did it and proved he could do it, and I guess the rest is history.
Well, it's one, you know, Orson at the time was doing these Gallo wine commercials. We'll sell no wine before it's time. So he was making a great deal of money, and he probably had no interest in doing it. But I must tell you, it is impossible to imagine the Twilight Zone without your father being the host.
Yeah.
And the first year, they never saw him. They just heard his voice.
Right. He was off camera, right.
Oh, my God. And what? The Twilight Zone, since your father had creative control, does his estate or your estate or your family's estate have the rights to the Twilight Zone now?
We don't have a right to the episodes, no.
Who owns the episodes, then?
My dad sold those to CBS, unfortunately. One of the larger mistakes he knew he'd made. But who knew back then? I mean, he thought it had run its course, it had run for 5 years, and that was the end of that. No one would be more shocked, John, than my dad that the Twilight Zone has survived all these years and has been introduced to young kids. In Binghamton, they do a program called The Fifth Dimension, where all the fifth graders watch the Twilight Zones and they learn about prejudice and scapegoating and mob mentality and peer pressure. And although these are only fifth graders, they really get this. And I said this in the book, I think this program would have been my dad's greatest accolade.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, each episode you see with each passing year glows more brilliantly with intelligence and brilliance, and you think, my God, why can't television be like that again? But it will never, ever, ever be like that again. Now, your father also got involved with writing a couple of films. What was one of the films that he wrote that he sort of liked?
He wrote The Man, which was actually based, he wrote the screenplay. It was the first African-American president. He wrote the first Planet of the Apes. He'd wanted to stay very true to the book, and my dad's original script, I guess, proved to be too expensive, and so then they brought on another writer. But that iconic ending is still my dad's. 7 Days in May was another one he liked. I think for the most part, you know, like with the Twilight Zone, he said that they'd had some turkeys, but for the most part, he was proud of most of the shows. And my dad and I didn't talk a lot about this, but I think, you know, he was proud of most of his work. There was another show we did called A Storm in Summer, which is a lovely, lovely script that my dad was quite proud of, too.
Well,
then he did The Night Gallery, which, unlike The Twilight Zone, he did not have creative control, and that proved to be a very challenging couple of years for him because it became a show that was not at all what he had intended. There was an emphasis on horror, and Jack Laird, the producer, and he really butt heads. And all that said, there were also some very lovely scripts in Night Gallery. One in particular that I loved was their a script called "They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar."
One of the actresses that was in one of the early episodes, Night Gallery was fascinating because of the fact that your father introduced it standing in front of these paintings, which was the Night Gallery. Sadly, he didn't have creative control. But you tell a cute story in the book about Joan Crawford being in one of the episodes. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was one. It was called Eyes, and it was actually directed by a very, very young Steven Spielberg. That was his first directing job. It was about a woman who was blind, and she wanted sight, and she had this operation. Do you want me to tell the whole thing? It was a good episode.
Tell me about the phone calls to your house in the Palisades.
Yeah, I remembered my dad had an office in the backyard, but the phone would also ring in the house. And when he was in the house, Joan Crawford was calling quite a bit. I guess she was a bit of a perfectionist, which might put it mildly.
Mommy dearest. Actress dearest. Okay.
Right, and he kind of had it. He was a little inundated with calls from her.
What were there any signs that your father was becoming ill?
You know, I wrote about that in the book, too. At the time, you know, he had Raynaud's disease, which is a circulatory problem, and we all knew about that. We knew he smoked too much. I didn't, you know, looking at him, he was always very tan, very healthy looking. He played paddle tennis. It was really looking in the photograph at the photographs after he died that you could sort of see what at least I wasn't seeing at the time, that he didn't look healthy. He didn't look good below that tan.
One of the things that you brought up that pleased me, because obviously your father, aside from reading and writing probably 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, is he had this need to somehow relax. And you talk in the book about how he did a show called The Liars Club. And I had to chuckle and smile at that. And you say, frankly, that he did it because he needed to have a little fun in his life. Well, I did the Canadian version of The Liars Show. A friend of mine, yeah, producer in Canada by the name of Blair Murdoch, bought the rights to The Liars Club, which sadly he no longer has and nobody else does. And it should be done because it's a fun show. And I, believe it or not, Anne, I got a fan letter today from a lady in Canada who watches every episode every day because they still run it up there. So I was delighted to see that. And then following your father, it was Alan Ludden, who also sadly died quite young. When your father went into the hospital and you gathered with him, did he talk to you about the possibility that he might not survive? And what were his thoughts about his life? What did he talk to you about?
He never said to me that he didn't think he would survive. It was something I'd overheard him say to the doctor about his chances being better when he was in the Philippines. He did make a tape when he was in the hospital about what it felt like to have a heart attack and how he realized, you know, what really he said. He wasn't so much afraid of dying. It wasn't dying that frightened him so much as the relationship that would die. And that's what he felt, this profound loss about this fear. But I think, you know, as I said earlier, I really believe my dad was feeling, and he had told friends this as well, that he was very optimistic that the surgery would help. His dad was only 52 when he died, also heart related. So well, there was definitely a genetic predisposition to this as well. But I really believe, despite the death of his own father so young, that my father thought he could beat this.
And aside from the stress of the work that he had to do, the important work that he tried to get done that the networks wouldn't let him do, that horrifying stress, your father was a very liberal humanitarian man who got involved with helping a lot of great, worthwhile causes. And the deaths of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy, which devastated and changed America forever, must have just really killed your father.
He was profoundly sad, you know, as was the whole country about this. And, you know, I've I've thought a lot about, you know, with all these insane politics going on and Donald Trump, et cetera, and the whole GOP. My father would, I think, initially be just apoplectic about what's going on, and then I think he would sort of sit back and be able to articulate it calmly, and but he'd get his message out there, and he would be initially though quite horrified by what's going on.
Well, we miss him. Quite honestly, we missed all those kinds of people. We missed the Gore Vidals of the world. We missed the Patty Chayefskys of the world. And American television, American literature will never see their likes again, sadly. But I would recommend your book, Anne, as I knew him, not only to anyone who is a fan of your father's work, but anyone who is really interested in the story of a young woman like yourself surviving this and moving on and getting married and having her own career. It's a wonderful, wonderful read. Where can people get your book? And what is it that you're working on now? And what is it you would like us to plug or mention on your behalf?
My book is available at Barnes & Noble, and it's available on Amazon. We also, my husband and I started Rod Serling Books. It's on Facebook, and it's a platform for established and new writers, because the publishing world is so difficult these days, and I think this is something that my father would have completely supported. And my book is also on the website. I'm presently working on a novel that, to quote my dad about a work that he was doing, he said he was working on a script called The Salamander, and he said that it was beginning to destroy him piecemeal. I can say that about my novel.
It's
been a challenge.
My favorite quote about writers is Dorothy Parker's quote. Dorothy Parker, as you know, was a member of the Algonquin Round Table back in the late 20s and 30s, and she said, "I hate writing, but I love having written."
Yeah.
And I'm glad you wrote this book, and I'm more than glad that I read it, and thank you so much for being here. You have a wonderful, wonderful holiday, Anne, and thanks again.
And thank you so much.
You're very welcome, dear. Have a great, great evening. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back with our regular, the best in the business, Joe Satilli. Be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
This is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
I love you. Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, welcome back to John Barber's World. This is John Barber. I'd like to thank George for that unsolicited, terrific review of The Last Word on the Assassination, which you can get at Amazon, and if you just go up there, you can also Google about 100 rave reviews written by people who've gone to the trouble to buy the DVD and then go back and write these reviews. While you're up there also, if you're looking for a laugh, you can get John Barber's first Facebook book, Uncensored, Volume 1. It's sort of a chicken soup for the funny bone. And also, I might suggest on November 22nd, we put up an hour and 10-minute free video. If you go to YouTube, or if you go to John Barber's World, and then just click on the YouTube icon, you can watch John Barber's last word on the Garrison tapes. And even if you have no interest in the murder of John F. Kennedy, if you have some interest in American media or a story of somebody who's tried to survive in that media and did do well at one time, I would suggest it is a great, great view. It's John Barber's last word on the Garrison tapes. Now for some great words. Just a man who deserves to have his own show, not only on the radio, but on network television. The guy is totally brilliant. He is the best, most informed journalist I know. He's the creator and author of News Vandal, which is the most objective newsletter that goes out every day. And not only is he a regular here, he's now a regular with Chuck O'Chelly, and I'm soon he's going to be a regular on Coast to Coast or someplace any place else. Anyway, Joe Satilli's his name. Joe, welcome back. Great to talk to you again.
John, imagine, if you will, a world in which a bloviating orangutan can obscenely insult three-quarters of the American population and still win the presidency. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. You are entering the Trump zone, John. We are witnessing one of the most amazing – I don't know. I've been around a while. You've been around a while. Have you ever seen anything like a candidate who can – by basically piecemeal, pick out a particular portion of the population, insult them, and continue to gain strength. Today, the latest poll, he's got 41% nationally among Republicans. He is now at 41%. This is in the wake of him calling for, I don't know, what would you call it? Sort of like a, you know, yellow star, Juden Nazi Germany kind of thing, where we're gonna track all Muslims. We're gonna monitor all their mosques. And oh, by the way, we're not going to allow any of them to come into the country. It has only made him stronger. You know what Nietzsche said? That which does not kill me makes me stronger. And that's kind of Trump's campaign slogan. That which does not kill me only makes me stronger.
I'll tell you basically what it is. I play golf twice a week with a couple of dozen guys in town here who are policemen and firemen and crap dealers and blackjack dealers and, you know, independent, successful businessmen. Half of them are, more than half, are Democrats. The other half probably Republicans. But they all say to a man, and I heard them this morning around the coffee table saying, you know, they don't like Trump, but they like the fact that he's saying something that nobody else will talk about. So it must be that appeal that somebody, you know, there used to be this thing about real independence and liberty in America. You know, the individual standing alone like Jimmy Stewart, one of those old Frank Capra movies, that has somehow been lost. And it's been regurgitated in a weird sort of way by Donald Trump's total independence and the fact that he does it off the cuff. You never see him up there with a note in his hand. Or a teleprompter like Obama. I mean, it just doesn't exist. And I must tell you, it's like I don't want to change the subject, but we'll get back to this because I have a question about a Canada, which was in your newsletter this morning. But when Leno Sanet came down to interview me, and Leno's going to be my guest in 2 weeks, about going on record as to why I got involved with trying to tell the Jim Garrison story and why I stayed involved with all of the trouble. And when did I what made me change my mind about it? Well, I mentioned to him that when Kennedy was shot, it didn't matter to me. My act was gone, as was Vaughn Meters. I said, but the first time I got suspicious was when Lyndon Johnson got off the plane at midnight and took out a piece of paper out of his pocket and had to read about his grief. And we found that clip and we put it in this hour and 10 minutes. And I hate to tell you this, but whenever I find that, I've seen it five times now, but when I come to that clip and he pulls out the piece of paper, I literally start to laugh because it is so obvious that the guy could not speak from the heart. But anyway, Trump, I guess, speaks from the heart. I think, you know, they did it in Nazi Germany. The brown shirts did it in Nazi Germany. And he's doing it here. I mean, one day he said they had he had a heckler. And they beat up the heckler. And he was sorry they didn't beat him more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing that I think is fascinating. And I'm calling him the Teflon Don. Because I think, remember, our Teflon president was Ronald Reagan.
Yes,
and Ronald Reagan could say, oh, I remember fighting in the war. And the people would say, actually, Ron, you were acting about fighting in the war. You weren't actually in the war. And he could get away with a lot of things. Even Iran-Contra, which is one of the – really, when you dig into it, one of the great scandals in the history of American political scandals in terms of illegality and unconstitutional actions. It makes Watergate look like, you know, look like nothing.
And Carter did nothing about it, and he was aware of what was going on.
So, well, and then when Clinton came into office, you know, he had a scandal on the Bush administration called Iraqgate. People don't know about this, but there was a secret pipeline that the George Herbert Walker Bush administration set up to put cluster bombs and other munitions in the hands illegally of Saddam Hussein in the years and months leading up to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. That was something that was never pursued. But we can get into the history of all the scandals that were never pursued. But what's amazing is that Reagan has emerged. I mean, he has one of the two major airports servicing Washington, D.C. is named after Ronald Reagan. And when you look at his rig, you're like, how did he do it? Because he was a Teflon president. That's where the term came from, because nothing would stick to him.
He also destroyed the Air Traffic Controllers Union.
Which is sort of the perfect irony of him having an airport, right?
That's yeah. Exactly right.
But when I look at Reagan and I look at Donald, I think they're really kind of the same person in some ways. They were both entertainers. They were both underestimated, or as the second Bush president would say, misunderestimated. And I think one of the things that I find interesting is that that Donald Trump has revived the Reagan Democrats. I don't, John, you'll remember the Reagan Democrats. These were the people from the Rust Belt, generally white, working class, not college educated individuals who dealt with terrible, terrible economic problems at the end of the 70s. Stagflation during the Carter administration was a nightmare. And Reagan came in on the heels of one of the great renewing moments in American history, the hockey win. That was a big moment. John, remember the Miracle on Ice? And the whole country was ready to feel good and I'm going to make America great again. That was basically Ronald Reagan's platform. That's Donald Trump's platform. And I think what has happened, I'm going to finish up very quickly, is that since Reagan came in and he basically made promises to the Reagan Democrats that were never kept, George Herbert Walker Bush never kept the promises. Clinton, I believe, was Reaganomics on steroids because he fully and completely turned over the Democratic Party to Wall Street and he turned over the American manufacturing base to China. By the way, Hillary Clinton was on the board of Walmart before Clinton, her husband became president. Walmart is the primary beneficiary of the most favored nation trade status that Bill Clinton gave to China in spite of in contradiction of his campaign promises in 1992. And that led to the further hollowing out of the white working class, the non-college educated working class. And it has been transgressed by one party after the other, by one political candidate after the other. And I think that anger, along with years of obvious political corruption, have coalesced into just what you're saying. Here's a guy who says Jeb Bush is going to be a puppet of his donors. And people say, yeah, that's probably right. He is saying super PACs are bad. They're bad for America. This is a Republican saying super PACs are bad. He's saying Wall Street has run amok and those hedge fund managers are getting away with murder. All of these things are things that sound really true to people. And, you know, if you look at the other, like you talk about teleprompters, when you watch Obama give a speech, it looks like he's watching a tennis match. His head goes left, right, left.
Well, I tell you, you have said two of the really smartest things I've ever heard. One was the thing about why is the Zapruder film still around when it could have been confiscated and hidden, as they hid all of the security footage taken around the Pentagon after 9-1-1 that showed no plane hit the Pentagon. It's there as a warning to anybody who thinks that they run the country, which I think is absolutely, totally brilliant. Now, to compare Trump to Reagan is actually right on, because Trump is always saying, I fund my own campaign. I don't know if you remember, but the most quoted line from Ronald Reagan was in one of these debates in New England. He said, wait a minute, I paid for this microphone.
And I actually have saved, this is what a geek I am for politics, I have saved a picture from that candidate's forum in New Hampshire, and there's a picture of Ronald Reagan sitting next to George Herbert Walker Bush. And Ronald Reagan looks like he has a giant silver shaft shoved up his rectum. And George Herbert Walker Bush has that sort of that smarmy grin on his face. And that's right after Reagan said, I paid for this microphone. And because Reagan was the anti-establishment candidate, and Herbert Walker Bush was the establishment candidate. And the story goes, and I don't think this is apocryphal, is that at the 1980 convention, Reagan, as he was moving towards the dais to accept the nomination, he did not want Herbert Walker Bush to be his vice presidential candidate. And Nelson Rockefeller pulled him aside in the middle of that convention and said, Ron, if you do not put Bush on your ticket, I will make sure you do not win this election.
Well, the sad thing is that George Herbert Walker Bush was the head of the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's right.
And the fact that that secret police chief became the president of the United States is an abomination. I have two quick questions to ask you related to two of the wonderful stories you have in News Vandal today. We have heard about countless suicides in Mexico after Clinton signed NAFTA and destroyed agriculture in Mexico. And we have heard of suicides in India by Indian farmers. This article about the oil pipeline in Canada leading to suicides. Explain that.
Well, Canada has actually had something of an oil boom over the years. And this is really where the whole Keystone pipeline comes from. There are these things called tar sands in Alberta. And for years, the tar sands, because of technology and because it's been easier to go to the holes that are the oil wells and dig into the holes that are easy to get to, particularly the ones in the Middle East, those tar sands were not economically viable. But those tar sands have become economically viable over the last decade, and their technology to turn tar sands into usable fuel has turned Canada into, some people call it, I think, the Texas of the North.
Yes.
And what it did is it created a massive boom. I mean, just wealth, incredible wealth. Well, what's happened is that because the United States has done the drill baby drill thing, it's funny, Sarah Palin pitched drill baby drill, but Barack Obama became the minister of drill baby drill. You know that the United States now is the, if you put oil and gas together, is the world's number one producer of both oil and gas. That's how much is coming out. So we are now in the middle of a massive glut, thanks in no part, small part, to the Saudis, who just destroyed the Venezuelan economy, which has led to the end of the sort of the political legacy of Hugo Chavez, which is destroying Russia. Russia is having a little bit of this problem that Canada is having as well, because they're an oil and gas economy. And so Canada now is suffering the fallout of what happens when you have a massive boom and a massive bust. And you know, John, you'll remember this. The same thing actually happened in Colorado under Carter. Remember shale oil?
Oh, yeah.
So there's this – shale oil is a lot like tar sands, and there was a big push for shale oil in light of the second – what was called the Middle Eastern oil shock, and that was the – second embargo that happened after the Iranian revolution, and oil lines started again, and you know, Carter's looking for all kinds of solutions, and they went to shale oil. Well, there was a little mini boomlet in Colorado in the late 70s from shale oil. It collapsed, after the Reagan administration came in and the spigot opened in the Middle East, and there were suicides and dislocations and drug abuse, and you know,
you just don't seem to think of Canadians as committing suicide, though.
But you know what happens, I think, is that you start living in this go-go economy, and everything is coming up roses, and then it stops. And it's this, you know, there's a great line from a song by Steely Dan called Black Friday. When Black Friday comes, I'm gonna stand down below and watch the gray men as they die from the 14th floor. You know, it's because the gray men, when the stock market crashes, they jump out the window. That's the old saying. And you know what, John, this is the thing that I think is important, is that when you think about places like Chicago, when you think about places like Ferguson, you think about places like South Central LA, you think about any of the places where you have dislocation, drug abuse, violence, suicide by cop. You know, a lot of these shootings end up being suicide by cop. There's a thought that this guy who was shot in LA over the weekend shot 33 times. I mean, that's the thing that blows your mind, right? I mean, 33 times? I mean, really? So, I mean, are you just trying to just eliminate all the evidence there, just turn him into a pile of material? But that was suicide by cop. If you look at these places, one of the common denominators is economic dislocation. And economic, when you take away a person's livelihood and they're living very, very high and all of a sudden it all goes away, even the Canadians, John, even your people, the great and moderate and mild Canadians can succumb to the shock of losing it.
Oh, that's sad. The other story that it's not a story that's getting much traction at all in the mainstream media, and that's the deal that was signed in Paris, this multinational deal to do something about climate and weather. And you have a wonderful article in today's News Vandal. I hope we have a minute or two to talk about it, about how Naomi Klein doesn't think that's going to help at all.
No, I'm actually also working on a piece that I'm hopefully going to deliver to Truth Out on Wednesday called The Mother of All Market Corrections. I think one of the things we're seeing here is that I liken this, and I think this is where Naomi is coming down as well, and also Bill McKibben and James Hansen have also criticized this. James Hansen in particular, who is the guy who started this whole ball rolling. This $100 billion to help mitigate the switchover of developing countries and these targets that are – there's really no enforcement mechanism. This is all window dressing. This is all pat ourselves back and feel good, because the bottom line is, as long as the hydrocarbon economy continues to run amok – and it's not really, folks, it's not just about CO2. Do you know plastics comes from petroleum? You know, exactly. That you have air pollution that comes from petroleum. You have particulate pollution. There was a story that I had last week, John. More people die from inhaling air pollution from car exhaust and the burning of hydrocarbons than from wars, terrorism, murder combined last year.
Well, on that depressing note, we're gonna say goodbye. But tell me where folks can get News Vandal, how they can get in touch with you. And when are you going to be on Chuck's show again?
I'll be on Chuck's show tomorrow night. That's American Freedom Radio at 6 p.m. in the middle of the debate. So I'll probably be squawking about the debates as they happen. If you would like to get the rundown, email me at newsvandal@newsvandal.com. You'll get that 5 days a week. And always remember to tune in. John, your introduction and the opening of your interview with Ann Serling was a truly moving moment.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you all for listening. In 2 weeks, we're going to have the incomparable Leno Sonic, who did John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison tapes. He is probably the best informer of information about the assassination of John Kennedy on Black Op Radio. Thank you all. Thank again, Joe. Have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A
sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.